host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might also be listening at CFBX Kamloops, CFIS Prince George, or online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, on the Co-Creator Network, or on Blog Talk Radio. And today I have a recording of an interview I did on Namaste Radio a few weeks ago, so I hope that you will find that interesting. I'm just going to play it straight through. This is Matthew Fox on Hildegard's Divine Feminine, and we're going to find out who Hildegard is, and she's just actually recently been sainted by the Catholic Church, and it's kind of interesting because, well, you'll hear all about it in the interview. So I hope that you are having a fabulous day, and we'll chat soon.
Matthew Fox is an internationally acclaimed theologian who was a member of the Dominican Order for over 34 years. He has a PhD in the history and theology of spirituality. He's the author of 28 books, and he's currently working on a new book about Hildegard of Bingen, which is the book that Namaste Publishing will be putting out very soon. Hello and welcome to the show.
Hello, Marie. Thank you. Good to be
Thank
with you.
You. How is the best way to address you? Is it Reverend, or how do you prefer?
Matthew's fine.
Matthew, okay, thank you. So I'm curious now, I'm reading the book about Hildegard of Bingen, and for those of us who don't have a background in Catholicism and aren't familiar, can you give us a little bit of a background on who this woman was and why she's so important now?
Well, she lived in the 12th century, and of course the 12th century was a time of a great renaissance in the West, in Europe. My mentor, Père Chenu, a French Dominican historian, said that the 12th century Renaissance was the only Renaissance that worked in the West because it was from the grassroots up, not from the top down like the 16th century Renaissance was. So the 12th century Renaissance included women and young people in particular freeing themselves from their serfdom in the feudal system that was breaking up. And so Hildegard was one of the greatest voices of that Renaissance, and she was literally a Renaissance woman because she was a superb musician, a scientist, a healer. She wrote several books on healing. She was a prophet. She criticized strongly the ecclesial leadership of her time, priests, bishops, abbots, and even the Pope. Wrote them letters that would shake anyone up today, and she even wrote the Emperor Barbarossa and the King Conrad, telling them that they had to pay more attention to justice. And she preached all over Germany and Switzerland, and which of course the last two papacies don't even allow women today to do. She was also a painter insofar as she had these visions, and we're not real sure if she painted them or she had her sisters paint them, but she definitely supervised the painting. But she was just an amazing Renaissance woman, and she wrote over 10 books, including science. She was very, very interested in science. I wrote a book on the healing power of animals and stones and gems and crystals, and there's actually a clinic in southern Germany still operating today. It's been going for over 35 years, based entirely on Hildegard's medicine, dealing both with physical ailments and with psychological ailments, because she had a theory about balancing what she called vices and virtues, but it really comes close to the work being done today, people like Dr. Larry Dossey and so forth, about the importance of meditation and balance, especially in a stressful existence. So Bobo, she was a herald of the divine feminine, and that's why she's so needed today. Obviously, patriarchy has exceeded itself, and the reason Earth is in so much peril and our economic system is so unbalanced and so many other things is that the patriarchal mindset has preferred knowledge as power to wisdom, and Hildegard was a real teacher of wisdom. And of course, wisdom is feminine in the Bible and in most around the world in other traditions as well. So to put wisdom first is to put a care and a concern and compassion for the poor and the oppressed and others, is to bring the balance of the sacred masculine and the divine feminine together again. That kind of balance is missing. So she's a force to deal with. She's a Trojan horse, really. It's amazing that the present papacy is canonizing her, making her a doctor of the church. There are only three other women who've been named doctor of the church in its 1800-year history. And I'm glad they're giving her that title, but she's a Trojan horse because she rattles things tremendously, and what she has to say about justice and about the divine feminine is extremely important today, and it's more than important that people in the Vatican hear this.
Wonderful. And so, Matthew, now I'm curious, that brings up so many questions about the divine feminine as well as the Catholic Church. You mentioned in the book how the Dalai Lama, when he was in Vancouver at the Vancouver Peace Summit, he said that the Western woman will save the world. And you point out that that is possible, but only if the Western woman steps back into her divine feminine power, because women have taken on this role of masculinity. They've kind of gotten on the patriarchal bandwagon, and we were out there working and producing and doing all these great things, but we're very much in our masculine energy. And so how does Hildegard help women to learn how to step back more into their divine feminine?
Well, the divine feminine is not squishy, soft, and overly feminine. If you think of the Black Madonna or think of Kali and so forth, there's a strength there. So the divine feminine is not without strength. I think the key, though, is the masculine. What do we mean by the sacred masculine? Because I would agree that many women in our culture are walking around with a debilitating and toxic masculinity, because just as men are. Because we live in a culture that has not critiqued patriarchy and the shadow side to masculinity, and we've not been showing the positive side to masculinity. So my previous book was called The Hidden Spirituality of Men, 10 Metaphors for Awakening the Sacred Masculine, and I think that's a very important brother book, cousin to this book on Hildegard and the Divine Feminine, because we have to clean up the toxic masculine. Even if the Divine Feminine returns, and it certainly has been returning for the last 40 years, and that's where the Dalai Lama, I think, is right on when he says that the Western woman can really help to save or heal the world. Nevertheless, the Divine Feminine is back, but she doesn't have a healthy consort. That is to say, the sacred masculine has not been cleaned up. It's toxic, and you can see it in the Vatican for sure. You can see it in the Taliban and Pat Robinson. You see it in all fundamentalist movements where there's an absolute rage against the feminine, a fear of the feminine that's irrational. You see it in the Vatican's most recent attacks, this time on the Catholic sisters in America. And even they're even going after their Girl Scouts, which makes me laugh. So the divine feminine is not without a healthy masculine. So just as a healthy man welcomes the goddess back, the divine feminine back in himself, as well as in his women friends and relatives, so too a healthy masculine should be welcomed by healthy women who need to clean up the toxic masculine that we're all walking around with in our culture. And Hildegard had a marvelous balance. There's nothing squeamish or mousy or inhibited about this woman. As I said earlier, she takes on the emperor, the king, the pope directly. And she actually says to the emperor that that God tells her that he's going to smite him unless he gets back to the work of justice. It's one of her favorite calling cards is a demand for justice, and she tells Pope that too. She says, "You're surrounded by evil and unjust men who cackle like hens." She goes on and on. It's really funny, but it's absolutely applicable to the Curia, the people who surround the Pope these days too. They're still cackling like hens.
So my question, Matthew, now is that, I mean, this woman back in the 12th century was, I mean, this very feisty and in your face and not apologizing for her opinions. And in even modern day Catholicism, it is very much a patriarchy. The divine feminine is not especially respected. And so why do you think that they're actually recognizing her now at this time?
Well, it's an irony, first of all, and I like irony. I believe in irony. As I say, it's a Trojan horse what they're letting into the Vatican in this regard. But another reason is, frankly, I think they're ignorant. I don't think they have a hermeneutic, that is to say, a methodology for understanding the full teaching of Hildegard, and that's what I think I bring to the table, certainly in this book, because I show how much a part of the creation spiritual tradition Hildegard is. For example, I begin the book with a quote from Hildegard. It's the vision she had, and it was a recurring vision. She had it more than once, and the vision is of a young woman, a beautiful young woman, and she learns that her name is Love, and that this young woman created the entire universe, and so the entire universe is created of love, and she includes Adam and Eve and the Earth. So, to me, that's exactly what I wrote about 30 years ago with my book Original Blessing. That's what she's writing about, Original Blessing. Well, the Vatican, what should I say? They went berserk over the concept of Original Blessing because they're so invested in original sin. Well, the truth is that I proved in my book 30 years ago that the Bible does not talk about original sin. It talks about a fall, but that's not the same as original sin. Jesus never heard of original sin. No Jew has ever heard of original sin. The idea was invented in the 4th century by St. Augustine, who was very dualistic and pessimistic and patriarchal. And So Hildegard, now she talks occasionally about original sin because that's in the conceptual baggage and language of the Christian Church since Augustine, but it is by no means out front with her. And in fact, she says redemption comes from the incarnation, that is to say, by divinity taking flesh. She talks very little, frankly, about the cross. She never paints a cross by itself. She only paints the cross a couple of times, and that's in the context of grace flowing into worship and so forth. So it's really interesting. And now today's scholars tell us that, in fact, the cross was not a symbol for Christianity until the 4th century. The earliest symbols of Christianity were the shepherd and the fish. The early Christians knew that it is true in the age of Pisces, in the age of the ram. And they believed that Jesus came along at the beginning of the age of Pisces. So fish play a big, big role in early Christianity. But the cross, no, not to the 4th century. So Hildegard, and she's working greatly out of intuition in this regard. I don't think she had the scholarship to know that the cross really came on board in the 4th century when when the church inherited the empire, when Constantine the emperor became a Christian and started to wage wars in the name of the cross.
Mm. And now, Matthew, it's interesting. There's a bit of a special relationship between you and Hildegard. Both of you, now in her lifetime, she was essentially excommunicated for a period of time because of all of her views and her vocalizing them so strongly. And there was also a time when you were shunned by the church. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Shunned is an interesting word. Sounds kind of Amish or something. But, yeah, I was expelled from the Dominican Order after 34 years by Cardinal Ratzinger, who's now the Pope, but at that time he was merely the chief inquisitor, head of the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith, which used to be called the Inquisition. The Sacred Inquisition, by the way. the year I was expelled, and I was the most read Catholic theologian in North America at the time, also Leonardo Boff, the most read Catholic theologian in South America, was squeezed out, and Eugene Drooman, the most read Catholic theologian in Europe, a German, as a psychoanalyst and priest, was expelled. So obviously it was a political act, and that's what's really scary about the last 40 years of Catholicism, that two popes now, the present pope and the previous one, have been determined to stifle theology and intelligent debate and discussion, which is contrary to both the spirit and the letter of the Second Vatican Council, which promised freedom of conscience afterwards people were expecting it. But unfortunately, and I write about this in my most recent book, just came out this past year, called The Pope's War, How Ratzinger's Crusade Imperiled the Church and What Can Be Saved, because I think story has to be told. Many people responding to that book have told me, gee, I just knew pieces, but your book puts it into a context. And there is a context, because there was a coup de grace, a takeover of the church by extreme right-wing forces. They even canonized someone, Escriva, a fascist Spanish priest who founded Opus Dei. They canonized him faster than any saint in history, and he actually praised Hitler. So there's some weird things that have been going on in the Catholic Church the last 40 years, and I'm just one of 103 theologians that they've silenced or expelled or chased around the block. Some of them have died of heart attacks. Some have had nervous breakdowns. Many are without work. I know one Dominican in France was last seen driving a taxi cab. It's been fierce, and there are powerful right-wing forces behind that movement, as I point out in my book called The Pope's War. So, Hildegard and I have a little of that in common, but you have to understand, now she was interdicted. That's like a group excommunication. So she and all of her nuns, she was the abbess, the head nun, were interdicted, forbidden to attend sacraments and so forth, when she was 80 years old. But the issue really was not her writings and so forth. It was not that. It was her refusal to give in to the archbishop, who wanted her to unearth a body of a young man, a revolutionary, whom she had buried on her property. And so they had this standoff. She said, I will not do that. And he said, you must. No, yes, no, yes, no. So then he interdicted her and all of her sisters, which was very, very painful for her. But actually, she did not give in, and after a year, he relented, and that body is still somewhere on that property 800 years later, so she won the argument. But she also wrote him a letter, and it's an amazing letter, in which she says that you silenced the music on the Rhine, the best music of all, which is, of course, her music, and she says, now, all prophets need music. David sang music and created musical instruments. She went on and on about prophets and music. And then she said that, but you have chosen to silence the music, And she ends it by saying, in the next life, you will go to a place where there is no music. Well, in her opera, she wrote the first opera ever in the West. In her opera, she has the devil walking around talking instead of singing because she thinks the devil doesn't sing. There's no music in hell.
Mm.
So she told the Archbishop he was going to hell, which is a pretty creative way of doing it, by saying that he'd be where there is no music. So I suspect that one letter is one of the bigger reasons why there's been a rather tardy canonization on this woman. But so she was not silenced for her ideas. She was silenced just for that one situation where she refused to obey the Archbishop.
And now I'm curious, Matthew, you mentioned that the Catholic Church and the Vatican has been very political over the past 40 years, but hasn't it always been a pretty political organization?
Well, I didn't say it's been so political. I said it's been right-wing political, been fiercely right-wing. For example, Pinochet, the dictator of Chile, was held up as someone admirable by the Cardinal Sodano, who was the papal legate there under Pope John Paul II, and then John Paul II picked him personally to be the Secretary of State of the Vatican, which is the number two guy in charge of the Vatican. And this guy was so close to Pinochet that Pinochet gave him awards and so forth. And Pinochet, meanwhile, was torturing and killing nuns and priests and lay people who were working with the base community movements, with justice movements in his country and throughout South America. So that's the kind of thing that went on under Pope John Paul II. And this is the kind of thing that I make clear in my book. So as you say, yeah, religion always gets involved in politics in some ways. And, of course, now there's a big stir in the American political scene over the some of the bishops are making loud noises about contraception and so forth regarding the presidential campaign here. It's one thing to be politically involved, such as so many Christians were after the Second Vatican Council in South America with the liberation movements there. But they were all squelched in the church by Pope, these last two popes. Instead, they held up someone like Father Maciel, who was the head. He started this organization called Legion of Christ, a religious order, and now it's been proven. And he was so close to the Pope, Pope John Paul II, that the Pope actually invited him on his plane when he would travel around and so forth, South America. He raised more money than anyone in the history of the church. And they found out that he, in fact, had sexually abused over 20 of his seminarians. And letters were sent by these seminarians when they became adults to Cardinal Ratzinger, who was in charge of this kind of thing. And he did nothing for 9 years, did nothing. And he even said, well, this man's done so much good for the church. We have to be prudent about him or some such thing. And so even after the press investigated the truth of these allegations, even after that, the Pope and Ratzinger did nothing. And Maciel was very close to Pinochet. He was very, very, very right-wing. And raises money that way. So you had these extreme right-wing groups, Opus Dei, Legion of Christ, and Communion and Liberation, three very right-wing groups, very, very well endowed financially, with great political backing as well, really having front row seats in the Vatican. And that's been going on for 40 years.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, we hear so many of these allegations of sexual abuse in the church, but I can imagine...
Well, they're not just allegations. These are, most of these have been proven in court. And as you probably know, the Catholic Church has spent billions of dollars on these cases, lost billions of lay people's hard-earned money, and you know, there, many are still unresolved, and bad things are still going on. There's an Opus Dei bishop in Kansas City that's been indicted. And, of course, there's this trial going on in Philadelphia of a Monsignor who is running the diocese, the cardinal's right-hand man, who saw these pedophile lists of pedophile priests and seemed to have not done very much about it. And, of course, Cardinal Law, most notorious perhaps of all, cardinal in Boston, he was close to being indicted, and because he had one priest alone who was passed from parish to parish and abused over 150 boys.
Wow.
And he did nothing about it. He passed them around parish to parish.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Attorney General of Massachusetts was coming after him, he went to Rome, and they elevated him. They promoted him to be in charge of a 4th-century basilica in Rome. That's where he's been all these years. Many, many people in Boston who know the facts, including Catholic lawyers and attorney generals, have said he should be in jail. But he's a cardinal, and he's actually helping to appoint bishops all over the world. So, I mean, there's a corruption going on in the Catholic Church today that is at least as bad as the Borgias. And the press has been very, very slow to see the whole picture or report on it. Although, obviously, with the pedophile crisis, finally, there's been some light shed on the situation. But the fact that the church has condemned over 103 theologians, that's equally important and significant, maybe even more so, because it means that the church is dumbing itself down. And it's the end of an era. That's what I say in my book on the Pope's War, that really this is the Holy Spirit ending the Catholic Church as we know it so that we can start Christianity over again, push the restart button. And that's so important. This is where Hildegard comes in, because she has real visions about, for example, an ecological theology and spirituality. And we talked earlier about the divine feminine along with the sacred masculine, and about the importance of justice, and about the importance of creativity. I mean, she was a walking incarnation of the creativity of the Holy Spirit. And she has a whole theology of the Holy Spirit as creator. She says, Holy Spirit, you are music. You are life. So one of the things I do in my book is I bring her together with the poet Mary Oliver, with scientist Albert Einstein and others, with Howard Thurman, the brilliant African-American mystic who was so important to Dr. King. He was Dr. King's spiritual advisor. And I also bring her together with Dr. Clarissa Mercola Estes, her wonderful book on Wild Woman, because in many ways Hildegard was how Estes is defining a wild woman, someone in touch with their instincts, who, as Estes says, thunders after injustice. Well, Hildegard did that. So Hildegard shows us a way to what a healthy Christianity would look like.
Beautifully said. Well, I want to ask you more about what that healthy Christianity is going to look like, but I'm also curious. It's my understanding that in order to become a saint, you have to have performed a miracle. What would you say is the miracle that Hildegard performed?
Well, I think she performed lots of miracles. I think just getting some sleep at night must have been a miracle for her. We have 36 of her paintings. We have 72 of her songs. We have the oldest opera in the West by several hundred years. We have 10 books. She was growing these gardens and these herbs and her whole medicinal healing thing. She was advising so many people. We have over 300 of her letters. Some are two hot shots, like I said, emperors and kings and popes and abbots, but some are two more ordinary people. She was traveling, and, you know, she didn't have a turnpike to travel on back then. She was traveling by boat and horseback. And she was running a monastery. In fact, several monasteries. She started a couple monasteries. And so, I don't know how much sleep she got. So just that's a miracle, the quality of her production and the quantity of it. Now, one of the miracles about Hildegard is that her work was preserved for 800 years, and that's because she was a member of the Benedictine Order, and the women Benedictines are very strong. Sister Joan Chittister, who's quite well known in American circles today as a theologian and leader, she's a Benedictine, and Benedictine women have a good, strong animus. They have the masculine energy there, and they get things done, and they protect their own. And so the Sisters of Hildegard, for 800 years, preserved all of her writings, her letters, her paintings, her music, all of it. Just an amazing trove of goodies. But then in 1944, when the American bombers were coming near Bingen, which is on the Rhine, they packed this all up and took it to a safe place, they thought, to be preserved, and that was to Dresden. And, of course, all of it was firebombed in Dresden. But they were smart. And before they took it, they had copied everything. And they had even photographed things back in the 1920s. So what we have today, for the most part, is these first-generation copies. Although we do have a few of the manuscripts, actually, that circulated in the Middle Ages. But that alone is a miracle, that we have all of her stuff. Of course, that also raises in my mind the question of how many women were as productive as she was, or even half as productive, but whose work we do not have preserved because they did not have a Benedictine order preserving it for them, you know. It raises kind of a sad question in my mind. But if she can reform the church today, I think that would be a miracle of miracles. And maybe that's what this canonization is about. Maybe that's what the book is about. Let's get her work out there and let it stir things up. And I think there are many women and men who would be happy to march with Hildegard today. Even in her own day, you see, she was criticizing church officials all over the place for the exact kind of things that are issues today, and yet she did it in a context where there was not a women's movement as such to support her, or a press, or email, or internet, or web that there is today. So that's part, I think, of what the Dalai Lama is saying, that that women, Western women in particular, have a voice today. Now, Hildegard had a voice that she acquired, you might say, on her own, although she had a wonderful woman anchoress to whom she apprenticed for many years as a child, because her parents gave her to this anchoress named Jutta when she was about, I think, 6 or 7 years old. And so she had this very personal, direct relationship and mentorship with this wonderful woman, Jutta. And then Jutta joined the monastery, and Hildegard went along. And then when Jutta died, about 30 years later, is when Hildegard took over the women's end of the monastery.
Well, thank you, Matthew. And I need to take a step back, because we actually have a question from a listener back on the topic of pedophilia in the Catholic Church. What do you think is actually causing it? What's causing the problem, and what's causing the cover-ups and the people basically getting promoted for doing this?
Well, you know, when the news first broke from Boston Cardinal Law's diocese, I was teaching that morning in our doctoral program at a University of Creation and Spirituality. And we had a discussion, and there was this businesswoman in the class, and she said, when this happens in business, the CEO is gone in 24 hours, no questions asked. So notice, there are several things in that one sentence. First of all, it happens in business. It happens everywhere. Look at the football coach in Penn State. It happens everywhere. But the issue is how it's dealt with. And so the worst crime is the cover-up, you see. It took Cardinal Law 2.5 years to leave his post, his place of power. And even then, as I alluded to earlier, he did so reluctantly. And even all the priests in the diocese signed a petition telling him to leave. He didn't pay any attention to that. It was when the attorney general came after him with papers that he fled. And he wasn't punished. He wasn't reprimanded. He was promoted. I mean, it's just appalling. It's beyond the pale. And so the first level of crime is the cover-up. And because any CEO, and that's what a bishop is, ought to know how serious pedophilia is and ought to do something about it when they hear about it. Jason Berry is a very respected Catholic journalist. He's the one who wrote a book with an ally, a friend, that exposed Father Maciel called The Vows of Silence. And then he more recently he's written a book on the financial scandals in the Catholic Church today. And in that, he points these things out about how much cover-up there was, for example, in Los Angeles Diocese, which is the biggest diocese in North America, and how much money. I mean, the bishop there, the cardinal there, spent over $700 million on legal cover-up about pedophilia and so forth. So that's the very serious part, is how it was responded to. But again, as far as why it happens, I mean, obviously, psychoanalysts have to be, and psychologists have to be called into the room for that. But it does happen. It happens with football teams, and it happens in churches, and it happens in Boy Scouts, and so forth and so forth. But again, the key is protecting the young people. Number one, and one way to protect them is to get to those who are the attackers ASAP. You don't pass them around, and you don't cover it up. And you see what's so clear from documents we now have, not just in North America, but Ireland, where it was horrible situations there, Germany, Belgium, and so forth. What's clear is that there was a protection of the institution came number one. That was the real thing, protect the institution. And that is contrary to all gospel values. Jesus didn't think that way, institutions. And institutions do not trump individuals. So that's really the underlying evil in all this. Now, one can say, well, what about forced vows of celibacy and all that? Well, I mean, vows of celibacy do not of themselves create perverts, not at all. And the East knows this. You have Buddhist monks who are celibate and so forth. But it is possible that a celibate life or a so-called celibate life may attract some people who don't know themselves well or don't know their sexual proclivities well, and they think it'll be a place to hide. And of course, it is a place to hide. But then again, so was the Penn State football team for this fellow being tried right now. So wherever there's power, people are often attracted to hang out there. And obviously, pedophilia is an abuse. It's a power issue more than it's a sexual issue, really. And that's where the church, if the church is off center and is putting power ahead of love and justice, then it's not doing its job. And so it is encouraging this kind of misbehavior.
And Matthew, you ask in your book, how asleep are we? Is this a symptom of our inability to fully awaken these hiding these controversies and sweeping stuff under the rug?
Well, fortunately, I think, as I said, the journalism is beginning to wake up to some of the shadows that religion carries, but believers should wake up to that too and should start questioning and get out of denial. I think that denial is very strong still in institutional religion, and that's a dangerous thing. Meister Eckhart, a great 14th century mystic and teacher, said that God is the denial of denial. So I think that Hildegard, like all spiritual teachers, tells us to wake up. And Jesus did the same. And waking up is the opposite of denial. And it's only when you wake up and when you see what's really there that you can do something healthy about it. You know, if you have a sore and don't acknowledge it, how are you going to heal it? It just festers. So moving beyond denial is very, very important. And in Hinduism, the sin behind all sins is what they call ignorance. But look at that word ignorance. It's about ignoring. It's about ignoring. It's denial. It's not facing the truth. And it's only the truth that sets us free, after all. So there is a lot of denial, unfortunately, in organized religion these days. And Hildegard is a prophet who trumpets and blasts through that, because her very words are, they make you tingle. They get to the marrow of your bones. They get into the cells of your body and soul, and they stir things up. And a lot of it is not about the darkness that we've been talking about. It's the opposite. It's about the ecstasies and the joy of living. And she's preaching about the love of life and the beauty. She's talking all the time about the beauty of the waters and the greening power and of nature and all this. So she's in love with creation. She identifies God with life itself and with creation. She has theology of the cosmic Christ, which is the teaching that the Christ or the divine light is in every being in the universe. And she's actually very optimistic, because she sees humanity as an intellectual force and a creative force. And she's the opposite of fundamentalist. She's not anti-science. She's always searching for science and knowledge. And she says all science comes from God. And she's trying to praise life and get us to praise it and to live it healthily and fully.
Thank you. And you've described her as Hildegard as a Trojan horse now, that her canonization has almost come from the Vatican's ignorance of really what she stands for, which is ironic and fabulous at the same time. And so so let's talk about, so before we can end the show, we've talked about the dark side of Christianity. So where do you see Christianity, this new, you mentioned pressing the restart button. So where is Christianity headed now that Hildegard is back where she belongs?
Back where she belongs. Well, I think it's headed, we've talked about this, I think it's headed to a new balance of the yin and the yang, the feminine and the masculine, the sacred masculine and the divine feminine. Very important. Meister Eckhart says all the names we give to God come from an understanding of ourselves. So if we don't allow the feminine into our naming of God, and the Vatican does not, the last two popes have forbidden priests to use the feminine pronoun on the altar, for example. So in other words, they're still passing on the notion that God is exclusively male and probably old and tired like they are too. that kind of male, long white beard. It's important to bring that balance back, and it's huge. I mean, just that balance alone would turn the Vatican inside out. Obviously, this is why they're so frightened of women. They don't want to ordain women or let them. It's not just that women aren't ordained in the Catholic Church. They're in no place in the Vatican in terms of decision-making at all. So so that's huge, bringing in the sense of God as mother. Hildegard has that. She talks about you are hugged by the in the arms of the mystery of God. She has many images of divinity as a circle, as curved, as round, and that's very maternal. She also talks a lot about wisdom, and I said earlier, this lady called Love who created the world. So she got that from the Book of Wisdom that says Wisdom, who's feminine, was playing with God for the creation of the world, and she was present for the creation. But in many ways, Hildegard's even gone further than the Book of Wisdom or the Book of Proverbs has in the Bible. And, of course, her theology of the Holy Spirit. Spirit in Hebrew, Ruah, is feminine. And it's important that she has such a well-developed theology of the Holy Spirit, and it's built around what she calls greening power or creativity. So it's about birthing. And she's saying we all have it, men and women alike, but we have to really give it our attention. And so in that way, she's also shaking up education, that education should be more about creativity and wisdom and less about knowledge and power. And she talks about how the church is not, she does not say the head of the church is the Pope or his curia, who she says are men who cackle like hens, mm-hmm. but she says the head of the church is the Word of God, the cosmic Christ. And that's present in everybody. And she says that the stones, the living stones of the church, are the lay people. And the clergy is supposed to be serving them, not being served by them. So she has an ecclesiology, an understanding of church that's extremely contemporary. The Second Vatican Council said that the church is the people of God. But that's been one of the big fights since the council. The last two popes said, no, the church is us. It's Rome. It's the Vatican. And everyone has to heal and do what we say. But that's not the teaching of Vatican II. And that is why I say in my book on Pope's War that the Vatican is in schism, because they've turned their back on the Second Vatican Council, on many teachings of the Council, not just that, but many other teachings as well, including ecumenism, the whole idea of going out to other traditions to find their spiritual wisdom and so forth. And I say they're in schism because in Catholic tradition, a council trumps a pope. A pope doesn't trump a council. So there's been this big split in the church. A lot of it, frankly, has been foisted by the American government and the CIA. I show that in my book. The right wing, again, wanted this split because they could not handle liberation theology and base communities in South America that came out of the Second Vatican Council and his passion for justice. And Hildegard is always talking about justice. She's always critiquing people in terms of justice, whether it's popes or emperors or kings or abbots. And so she would be embroiled in these battles, I think, today as well, and for the very same reasons. So a church that really leads in terms of justice for the poor and so forth, this is the kind of church that Hildegard would envision for us.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Matthew, for being on the show today. It's almost time to wrap up, and so I'm wondering if there's anything you really want to get across today that I haven't brought up.
Well, it'd be fun if we could just read some of her words, because her language, what should I say, it carries its own beauty and power. I wish I had the very first page of the book with me, but I don't. But here's one of her writings. Do you have it?
I can bring it up. I'll look for
first
it.
First page of the introduction?
Yes.
Do you have
that? I'll look for it.
Where I have her talking about this beautiful lady. But I do have some pages here. Let's see. This is pages I have happen to be about the... pardon me, the attacks she had of against the Pope and abbots. So here's her writing to the Pope. O man, you will be so shaken that the strength of your feet, the feet on which you now stand, will disappear. For you don't love the king's daughter, Justice, but as in delirium of sleep, you push her away from you. That is why she will flee from you, unless you call her back. And you, O man, who have been placed as a visible shepherd, rise up and hasten quickly to Justice, so that you will not be criticized by the great doctor. That's her name for God, the great doctor, for not having your flock from dirt, for not having cleansed your flock from dirt, for not having anointed them with oil. So that's just one of her paragraphs that she wrote to the Pope. And she had actually met this Pope in person at one point. But she met the Emperor also in person, but that did not slow her down when it came to addressing these people, she felt they needed her counseling and advice. Here's a letter to Abbot Kuno. I've heard from the Lord, O human being, why do you sleep? Why do you have no taste for the good works that sound in God's ears like a symphony? Why do you not search out the house of your heart and renounce your brazen unruliness? You strike me in the face when you push away my members in their woundedness without looking at me. Why do you shrink from destroying a person since it wasn't you who created him? And she goes on about, oh, Justice, you are without a homeland. You are a foreigner in the city. She talks often about finding the house of wisdom in your heart. Pursue the house of wisdom in your heart. She has many, many phrases like that that are very visual. And because she is very visual, her visions were, that's why she painted them, you know. She paints a picture, for example, of the Christ as a man in sapphire blue. She says this is a healing Christ in everybody, a man of compassion and creativity. And that's, of course, the blue man archetype that I write about in my book on the hidden spirituality of men. These 10 archetypes, one of them is the blue man. And interesting enough, Swami Muktananda, the Hindu saint, 20th century, he also had a great meditation, a vision of the blue man, a pearl growing out of an oyster, morphing into a blue man. And he said this was the most important meditation of his whole life because it got him in touch with his creativity and with his powers of compassion and healing. So he in the 20th century and Hildegard in the 12th century had very parallel meditation experiences around the blue man. So that alone is a very wonderful contribution she makes, and that is about the healing Christ in all of us, to put it to work and to get compassion moving again.
Beautiful. Well, I'm afraid we're running out of time here. I did find the first page of the book.
Does it have a paragraph, which is a quote from her right at the beginning?
There
is. The introduction?
There's a quote about words that she said to the Pope. Rome.
No, not that. No. I think you may have an earlier version when that one paragraph wasn't there.
All right.
Sorry about that.
Well, where is the best place for people to get in touch with you and find out more about the work that you're doing?
MatthewFoss.org, www.MatthewFoss.org, 2 T's. That's my webpage, and you can find out there a lot about what I'm about, and my administrator, Dennis Edwards, how to get hold of him, and so forth, if you want to talk or host a speaking engagement or retreat or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, MatthewFoss.org. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you today, and I look forward to the full version of the book when it's out. Through now.
Well, thank you, Marie, and thank you for having a program like this.
Thank you. Very needed.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And that was Matthew Foss on Hildegard's Divine Feminine. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks so much for being with me today. I want to send, as always, I always like to send love out because it just feels really good. And I kind of, in my experience, it's sort of been that the more love that you send out into the world, the more that comes back to you. So I hope that you have a fabulous day, a fabulous week. Coming up in just a moment is Parts Unknown, and I'll be back with more Synchronicity next week. Love you so much. Be well. Have a great week. Namaste.